All right then, from Bhikshu Jagadish Kashyap to Dalito Rinpoche, whose name may possibly be more familiar to at least some of you. He was called Dalito Rinpoche because he was born in Darsen Do. He's the Rinpoche, the incarnate Lama, the Tuku of Darsen Do. Darsen Do is a town on the border between eastern Tibet. I think it must be Kham, I'm not quite sure, and China. It's right on the border. And Rinpoche actually was only half Tibetan. His father was Chinese. His mother was Tibetan. Although I knew his mother, by the way. She lived with him in Kalimpong for a while and died at a quite advanced age. And I'm afraid she gave Rinpoche quite a lot of trouble. She was a very hot-tempered old lady. But anyway, that's another story. He was born in 1918, and as I've said, he was a Tuku, or incarnate Lama. Once I asked him if he remembered any of his previous lives, and what he said was very interesting. He said he remembered remembering, but he could no longer remember. He just remembered remembering. He said, up to the age of 7, he did have some recollection of his previous life. And he further told me that this was quite common, that quite a number of the incarnate lamas or tukus did have recollections of previous lives up to the age of 7, but then they faded away. And he further told me that there was one particular incident that he could remember now, not just remember remembering, but actually remember. He said when he was about 4 or 5 and had been recognized as the reincarnation, to use that term, of his predecessor, an elderly woman came to the monastery and invited him to take a meal at her house. And he said no. So she was quite upset. Oh, Rinpoche, why won't you come to my house, eh? So on and so forth. So he said, and he remembered this, he said to her, why should you be, so upset? After all, I've come to your house many times before, which he had in his previous life. And he said he remembered that. And that's why he spoke to her in that way, eh? That she shouldn't think he wasn't, that he was refusing her invitation. He had, in fact, eaten at her house many times before, and she recognized the fact. Anyway, when he was still quite young, he left Darsen Do, and he studied at one of the great monastic universities in Lhasa, one of the great Gelugpa, or Yellow Cap, establishments. I should perhaps mention that his line, that the line of the Darsen Do Rinpoches was actually Nyingma, not Gelugpa. But I gather that the 13th Dalai Lama had insisted on his predecessor being educated as a Gelugpa Lama. The 13th Dalai Lama, it seems, was rather apt to do that sort of thing. He sent Nyingma Pa reincarnations to Gelugpa colleges for study. So, he also was sent to one of the great Gelugpa monastic colleges in that way and pursued his studies. He became a geisha, and he also went to the tantric college, one of the 2 tantric colleges, but he told me he was unable to study there or practice there for more than a year because his health just gave way. The life there was very, very rigorous. There have been people in the West who thought of tantric Buddhism as a bit, as it were, self-indulgent, not to say sort of transcendental hedonism, but by Rinpoche's account, the life there was very, very strict indeed. They were only allowed to use one blanket at night, even though it was very, very cold, things like that, and his health didn't stand it, so he left. But he was in line for the headship of the Gelugpa order, that he was in line for the position of T. Rinpoche, as he's called. In about 1946, I don't have any reference here with me, but I think it was in about 1946, the Dalai Lama sent him to India to be the abbot of the Tibetan Gompa in Buddha Gaya, and also to be the Dalai Lama's cultural and religious representative in India. And it was in Buddha Gaya that he saw me. I say saw me because I didn't see him. I only learned this many years later. In fact, he didn't tell me this story. He told it to one of our order members who visited him in Kalimpong just a few years ago. Apparently, this is what Rinpoche said, he was standing on the flat roof of the Tibetan Gompa in Buddha Gaya and looking down onto the nearby Mahabodhi Society. And he saw in the Mahabodhi Society a yellow clad figure. And he noticed that this yellow clad figure was European. And he thought to himself, well, that's wonderful. Even Europeans are now following the Buddha Dharma. And he said he was quite struck by this fact. And when we did eventually meet in Kalimpong, he recognized me as the person whom he'd seen on that occasion without my knowing it. But they said this story transpired only some years later. And yes, it was in Kalimpong that I met him in 1953. I just met him. We didn't become very closely acquainted, at least not in the ordinary sense. I think I can say that at that time I became very closely acquainted with his mind and with his understanding of Buddhism. Because this is what happened. There was a young Tibetan in Kalimpong called Lobsang Lalungpa, not Lobsang Rampa, Lobsang Phuntsog Lalungpa, who has recently published a new translation of the life of Milarepa. And he had been asked by the editor of a book on Buddhism, subsequently published as The Way of the Buddha, it was Kenneth Morgan who edited it, to write the chapter on Tibetan Buddhism. So Lobsang Lalungpa didn't feel that he was personally qualified. He consulted Dalto Rinpoche. Dalto Rinpoche expounded various aspects of the Dharma. Lobsang Lalungpa wrote them down, and then he brought them to me. So I went through them with him, and I rewrote all that material in what I hoped was decent English, because Lobsang Lalungpa's English at that time was rather weak, to say the least. But the Dharma that was communicated came from Dalto Rinpoche. And sometimes Lobsang Dalungpa's writing was not clear. That is, his exposition was not clear. I said, well, this isn't clear. Please go back to Rinpoche and discuss it with him and then write it out again in the light of Rinpoche's further explanations. So that is what he did. So it was back and forth in this way for 3 whole months. This, by the way, was the time when I was writing my survey. So a little bit of that information passed into the survey at that time. Though not very much, because I didn't have much to say about Tibetan Buddhism, as you may know, in the survey. But anyway, in that way, in that manner, I came in contact, I may say, with Dalai Lama Rinpoche's mind and his very deep understanding of the Dharma, his very deep understanding of Buddhism. Subsequently, I was associated with him in the founding of his school for Buddhist refugee children, a school where half the day was devoted to modern studies and half the day to traditional Tibetan studies, especially to the Dharma itself. But it wasn't until 1956 that I really got to know Dalai Rinpoche at all well. He was not the sort of person who sort of projected himself or went out of his way to meet people or make friends in a way. He was quite reserved. But in 1956, we happened to be, as it were, thrown together. You may remember that that was the year of the 2500th anniversary of Buddhism. The government of India was sponsoring the celebrations on quite a grand scale. And as part of the celebrations, they invited 57 eminent Buddhists from border areas to Delhi. Dalai Rinpoche was one of those 57 eminent Buddhists from border areas. I was another. And the government of India very kindly gave us a special train, and the train took us around the holy places, also of course to a few factories and dams and things of that sort, which the government of India wanted us to see. But Dada Rinpoche and I were both there together, and somehow we always stuck together. We seemed to, well, really like each other's company. There were Theravada bhikkhus from Assam, there were lamas and nuns from Bhutan, there were lamas from Sikkim, and well, there were also others from the Dark, and so many Buddhists from border areas. And all of us, well, eminent and guests of the government of India for that trip. So Rinpoche and I always shared the same carriage. We sat beside each other on the coaches, and we got to know each other really quite well in the course of that little tour. There's all sorts of stories I could tell. I'll only tell one story which illustrates Rinpoche's mindfulness. In fact, I may say almost his supernatural mindfulness. What used to happen was this: this government train would take us from one holy place to another, and we had a sort of official guide. And usually what happened was we saw a holy place in the morning, and we saw a dam or factory in the afternoon. And the guy used to say, well, this morning we're going to the holy place, and this afternoon we're going to the factory. So if we were going to the holy place, you know, we'd always take incense and candles and so on and so forth to perform a little puja. So one day, I think it was Kusinara, the guide said, no, we're not going to the holy place this morning, we'll go this afternoon. This morning it's something else. So we didn't bother about, you know, candles or incense or anything of that sort. So off we trooped. But it so happened that actually, I don't know as the result of what sort of muddle, but we found ourselves in a Buddhist temple in one of the holy places, and we hadn't got any candles or any incense. And for traditionally minded Buddhists, that's a big thing, to turn up at a holy place with nothing to offer. So all 57 people were really quite upset, except Dada Rinpoche. Tibetan monks, you know, got these very voluminous red robes. So while everybody was sort of expressing their regret and being a bit annoyed with the guide, Rinpoche sort of unfolded his capacious robe and pulled out bundles of incense, bundles of candles, and distributed them to everybody. Not quite enough for all 57 of us, a big smile. So he wasn't only mindful, you never seemed to catch him napping. I noticed this subsequently. You could never catch him. Not that people tried, but there were all sorts of situations where he might have been caught up, but he never was. Just like on that particular occasion. He always seemed prepared. He always seemed to anticipate what was going to happen and to be ready for that, ready to meet it. So I never forgot this incident, because it did illustrate this quite prominent characteristic of his.